Welcome to the Diplomats podcast on geopolitics in Asia. I'm Ankit Panda from New York.
I'm Zachary Keck from Washington.
Today we have Shannon Tietzi with us, who is our editor on the China Power blog. We'll be devoting this podcast entirely to China-specific issues. In particular, we'll be discussing Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi's trip to New Delhi. It looks like China is undertaking a sort of foreign policy reset with India following the election of India's new government. And after that, we'll take advantage of Shannon being with us today and talk a bit more about the CCP's new recruitment strategies and how that might affect the future of the party in China. So I'll just briefly talk about Foreign Minister Wang's trip to New Delhi. So it marks the first official interaction between Xi Jinping's government and the government of Narendra Modi. Modi was, of course, elected in India in mid-May, and his party won a massive victory, taking an outright majority in the parliament. And it's expected that Modi will take India in a new direction when it comes to economic policy, foreign policy, and social policy. So it looks like China decided to seize the opportunity and make a quick diplomatic overture. Wang traveled to New Delhi as Xi's official representative and met with a whole host of officials in India, including the foreign secretary. What set this trip apart from other diplomatic interactions between China and India, at least recently, is the rhetoric. While China is known for using lofty diplomatic rhetoric in most of its interactions with foreign countries, Wang's trip focused particularly on Modi. He called Modi an old friend to China, and he essentially said that that China was really happy that Modi won India's election, and he felt that with Modi's election, essentially the Modi's election injected a new vitality into an ancient civilization, and that his election will contribute to the national resurrection of both India and China, essentially kind of hearkening back to the sort of post-colonial solidarity that existed in the early days of India-China relations between, say, Zhou Enlai and Jawaharlal Nehru. Shannon, can you tell us a bit about how the Chinese media talked about this visit? Because I think there were some interesting statements being made there as well.
Yet the Chinese media, as you mentioned, had a very interesting personal focus on Modi himself. You talked about they see new vitality, new vigor for India coming with him. They mentioned in the foreign ministry statements that were widely circulated amongst Chinese media that China-India relationship is at a new historical starting point with Modi's election. I think Modi's background as the head of Gujarat in India makes him kind of a known figure to China. He had a lot of business connections. He's encouraged Chinese investment. So they see him as a known quantity. They think they can work with him. And I think they're very excited to do so, especially on the economic field. India is going to be an important part of China's push westward with the new Silk Road, the new Maritime Silk Road, and also the China-India-Myanmar economic corridor that they're planning. So before Modi's election, I think there was some concern in China about whether they would be able to work with India to really make this vision come together. And with Modi now assuming the top post, there's a lot of excitement that his focus on economics will allow Beijing to achieve its strategic interests in the region.
Yeah, I mean, at the same time, Modi, when he was campaigning for prime minister, he did call out China. He particularly referred to China's expansionist attitudes in a speech in Arunachal Pradesh, I believe, in the northeast of India, where the two countries have a territorial dispute. It seemed like during Wang's visit, he was very keen to sideline the disputes between India and China and focus more on economic cooperation. Zach, this applies to you too. I mean, do you guys think that this is a function of China's current disputes to its east with Vietnam, the Philippines, and Japan?
I mean, I would say that in general, I think China has been. I mean, they had the border. India and China had the flare up on the border dispute last year. But in general, I think China's really been trying to keep its land border disputes, or its land neighbors, with especially Russia and India, embrace them while it has all these sea disputes. Because obviously, if tensions flare up too much between China and India and China and Russia, then China's going to have to devote itself more to its ground forces and less into the maritime and air forces.
Yeah, I agree that China might be trying to play up positive relations with India while relations in Southeast Asia aren't going so well. One factor might be because Modi has this image as maybe more of a foreign policy hardliner. Beijing might be less willing to provoke him, more or less, the way the border incursion last year was sort of a challenge to Congress. And another interesting factor is Xi Jinping has been promoting this new concept of Asian security mechanism, and he might be hoping to get Indian buy-in. It's well, very tentative right now, but there's been a lot of talk while Wang Yi was in New Delhi emphasizing the special Asian-ness of India and China and their role as the two great civilizations of Asia and how they can work together to really build Asia into the powerhouse that they both think it should be. So this might be a precursor to trying to get India to support Xi's new security mechanism for Asia, as it's looking increasingly less likely that countries like Vietnam will be willing to do so.
Yeah, that's really, like I said before, that's really a throwback to the 1950s, the rhetoric that kind of defined India-China relations at that time. I mean, before the 1962 war and everything changed. I'm actually really happy you brought up the April 2013 incursion, because, I think it's an interesting hypothetical exercise to imagine how a Modi government might respond or might have responded to that dispute. As listeners might know, the Congress government under Manmohan Singh was particularly a good and practicing restraint, no bullets were exchanged between Indian and Chinese forces. The dispute just involved Chinese troops crossing the line of actual control, which demarcates the Chinese side of the disputed Kashmir territory from the Indian side. And it's conceivable that a Modi government, not particularly because of Modi himself, but because of his constituents and other members of the BJP, might be more likely to have responded with less restraint in such a situation. I guess another question I have is, do you guys think that Pakistan has a role to play here? I mean, we're witnessing a slight change in China-Pakistan relations recently, particularly with the Taliban ramping up. Do you think that China is trying to hedge its bets with Pakistan by coming closer to India?
I don't know. I was going to say with Pakistan, I think this is what's going to has the potential to destroy a good Indo-China relations during under Modi and Xi, because I think if there was like a Pakistan terrorist attack, Anka, you've talked about this, on India is not going to respond with any restraint. I think that in going after Pakistan, that's going to put China in a tough spot, and also India's going to want to lean on China. Modi and India will lean on China to reduce their support for Pakistan. So I think Pakistan has the potential to cripple this positive tone that's characterized the relationship so far.
Mm. One really interesting thing about Wang's visit is they really didn't focus at all on security issues. It was mostly economic. China has been increasingly talking about anti-terrorism cooperation. Obviously, with recent attacks in Xinjiang and elsewhere in China, it's a growing concern for Beijing, but they didn't really bring this up at all in their portrayal of what was discussed at Wang Yi's visits with Modi and India's foreign minister. And that might be out of concern in Pakistan, that India-China cooperation in the security realm, and particularly in the anti-terrorism realm, will be aimed at Pakistan and will be negative. So we might be seeing that pressure come to bear already.
Right.
Yeah, and while Wang was in India, the Pakistan's chief of staff was in China. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, just to go back to the Pakistan point real briefly, I think that, both India and Pakistan provide completely different benefits for China itself. I mean, from a Chinese national interest perspective, the benefits to be gained by closer economic cooperation with India are completely discrete compared to what it gains from Pakistan. Just one thing before I forget to mention this that was actually really interesting during Wang's trip to New Delhi was the issue of the Tibetan leader, Lobsang Sangay, who's the leader of the Tibetan government in exile. And he actually had a front row seat at Modi's inauguration, which actually prompted a formal complaint from the Chinese foreign ministry. And I believe Wang's trip in New Delhi, there were a whole host of pro-Tibetan protesters essentially following his motorcade around and saying that China should ease up on Tibet a bit. How do you, with this sort of reset that's happening in India-China relations, how do you guys think the Tibet issue will square with China's plans for just pure economic engagement with India?
I think it's hard to see that being a more important factor than, say, the border dispute or China's close relationship with Pakistan. Human rights concerns in general haven't played a defining role in the China-India relationship. Obviously, Modi was sending some sort of message by inviting the leader of the Tibetan government in exile to his inauguration, but it might just be a more general, you know, India is not going to appease China in every respect sort of message, as opposed to an actual strong message that India will increase its tangible support for Tibet.
Mm-hmm. Zach, do you have anything
to
say
about
that?
With that?
Yeah. Okay.
Not really. I would just, the only thing I'd say with the Uyghur problem flaring up also, that China might actually be not wanting to rock the boat on the Tibetan issue right now. Last thing it needs is both the Tibetans and Uyghurs going at one time.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I guess we'll see if this reset actually leads to anything. I mean, you know, the other example of a foreign policy reset hasn't been too successful, evidently, as we observe with U.S. and Russia relations these days. So I guess we'll see where India and China end up. I mean, we've seen this sort of rhetoric before from the Chinese side, and then, you know, you get an incursion like the April 2013 incident. You know, as we discussed on the podcast a few weeks ago with Jeff Smith, the perception of China and India is pretty, you know, there's a lot of skepticism still from the 1962 war, and India, conversely, in China isn't viewed as much of a threat. It's more, you know, the focus in China is a lot more on Japan and other countries, and the United States especially. So we'll see how that affects the dynamics here. I guess let's take the conversation over to domestic issues within China. Zach, do you want to take over here?
Yeah, well, this week it was interesting. Chinese state media were reporting that the CCP is going to overhaul the rules for recruiting and admitting new parties. And actually, Shannon, you wrote a piece on this, so maybe you want to just explain exactly what was the new guidelines are or what the goal is.
Sure. So the CCP's State Council Information Office, with a State Council being China's equivalent of a cabinet, announced that for the first time in over 20 years, they're overhauling the recruitment requirements for the Chinese Communist Party. The main theme was that they want to focus on quality rather than quantity. Right now, the party has about 80 million members, and there's a sense of concern that by expanding to that size, they've sort of sacrificed something in terms of both the moral and the ideological quality of the party, and this is sort of an attempt to get that back. So it's two-pronged. On one end, they want to prevent people who aren't meeting the new higher standards, both in terms of ideology and in terms of moral quality, from entering the party in the first place. But there's also a push to get rid of those members that are seen as not pulling their weight or not being a positive representation of the party. So it's an interesting kind of bookend to the grand opening of the party that started under Jiang Zemin back in the 1990s, when he for the first time said, you don't need to be a member of the proletariat. You don't need to be a farmer or a factory worker to join. You can join if you're a thoroughgoing patriot, was his term. If you love China enough, anyone, businessman, entrepreneur, college professor can join. And now it seems that they're starting to shy away from that a little bit, get back towards ideological concerns. And I think it's really at heart, it's an attempt to improve the central party's control over what's going on at the local level.
Yeah. When I read this, I thought, I mean, like you said, it's a major shift from Zhao Liming. In terms of the strategy then was to co-opt a lot of these intellectuals, businessmen, and different sort of other important constituencies in China, bring them into the party so that I think it was partly in reaction to Tiananmen Square, of course. So do you think this is going to – if they decrease the amount of members in the Communist Party, there's going to be less people with stakes in the survival of the system. So do you think this may be a long-term issue for them?
It's definitely possible. It depends how they go about weeding people out of the party, I think. There's signs that they're going to really tie this to the anti-corruption drive. So corruption obviously would be grounds for being expelled from the party. I think that they're also really looking to kind of redefine what it means to be a party member in ways that are not entirely clear yet. There's kind of an overall background of a push from Xi Jinping and other top leaders to create more of a systemic sort of rule of law atmosphere within the party, where they're overhauling not just the recruitment, but the way that party policies and party rules are made. So if that's really what they're going for, if they're trying to turn this into kind of a professional political organization with rules and regulations, then that could actually help the party's image in the long run. Right now, there's a general sense that corruption is a major problem. A lot of people are simply joining the party because they want the material benefits, the wealth that comes from doing that. And I think this is their way of trying to combat that. And as you said, you know, it might backfire on them if you have these people who used to support the party and that now have no reason to do so. But they're gambling that by improving the way they control the party, they can improve its image and increase their legitimacy long term.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with this economic point. I think this is one part that was missed in a lot of the stuff I was reading. I mean, definitely in the Chinese media, obviously, but even abroad, was how this ties into the economic rebounds. Because it's my understanding that, you know, really what they're trying to do is shift away from. They're trying to shift towards domestic consumption, trying to shift income over to the Chinese households and away from these the party and the affiliated businesses and stuff. So do you think this has to do with them? They figure if they can lower the number of people in the party, they can kind of lower the number of people who are part of this system of taking money, of benefiting from China's like repressing household income?
I think it's even tied into it on a broader level, which is that they are hoping to increase the amount of control that the central party has over all of the local branches. I know you've written a piece before, and I have too, about how hard it is for the central government to actually get its reforms enacted on a local level. And one of the ways that they're trying to do that right now is by increasing the rules and regulations that the central party organization can bring to bear on these local party officials. And that, in theory, will help them increase the responsiveness to these officials in implementing the different reform packages that they have. And as you said, another consequence of that could be that the less people there are in the party, the less people there are that are going to be corrupt, and the less people there are that will be within the party working against these reforms.
Is there a focus on the ideological in this era of reform? Essentially, I mean, we've been seeing a bit of focus on ideology when it comes to the PLA. There's been a focus on Marxist philosophy. Do you think that with these reforms, the CCP is going to be more picky, kind of like returning to a pre-Jiang Zemin era in terms of how it hires or recruits its members? Will it be testing their ideological mettle and their commitments to the tenets of Marxism in China?
I think that's incredibly likely, given that Xi Jinping has already started implementing tests for journalists, for lawyers, for other key constituencies.
Right,
Very interested in promoting what he calls socialism's core values. He wants the internet to be a mouthpiece for socialist core values. He wants the media to be a mouthpiece for this. Well, what's interesting is how he defines socialist core values really doesn't have anything to do with Marxism, Leninism, or even Maoism. there hasn't been a great definition of what exactly that means, but when they did release a list of words, this was done by the Chinese media, not officially by Xi, that were supposed to encapsulate these socialist core values, it was the same sort of things that the CCP has been promoting all along, harmony, stability, even democracy, although presumably that's democracy with Chinese characteristics. So, you know, he is pushing for some sort of value system. Right now, it's not exactly clear what those values are and how closely related they actually are to strict Marxist ideology.
We should add, he gave that important speech, and there was that issue Directive 9 last year, I believe it was, where he basically said, it was a speech that leaked, it was a private party speech where he said that he was talking about the downfall of the Soviet Union, or the demise of the Soviet Union, and he said, like, his interpretation is it fell because the people within the Soviet Union party, Communist Party, were not willing to stand up for the ideals of the party. They became soft. They weren't like, so there has been this push even before now to re-emphasize morals and values and ideology, basically. Like Chan said, it hasn't been very well defined by what he decided to push, but he has wanted to push this ideology. And I again think that this is tied into the fact that for, you know, at least I would say during the Ding period too, but at least since the 90s, there's been more and more people have been joining the Communist Party just for the financial benefits of being a party member. And now those benefits are going to decrease, or at least they're going to have to decrease if China wants to rebalance its economy. And so I think probably the top Chinese leadership is trying to figure out what are we going to do to replace the money aspect of why people join the party. How can we get people to still want to join the party or people that are part of the party still be loyal if they're not financially benefiting as much? And the only way to really do that would be to get them excited about the party and about ideology, just in the same way that he's using the Chinese dream and Chinese nationalism to kind of, you know, get people to continue to support this, including its own members, without the financial benefits.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Zach, because the whole speech in Directive Number 9 poses the interesting flip side to socialist core values, which is on one hand, you have the values that you're promoting, but on the other hand, that also allows Xi to sort of blacklist anything that he sees as threatening to the party that's not part of socialist core values. So the flip side of his speech on how the party needs to capture people ideologically was also, these are the things that we cannot allow to compete with us for influence. And those, of course, were the ideas of universal values, Western-style constitutional democracy, this whole laundry list of values that he sees as incompatible with China's system that need to be strictly kept away from Chinese people, both online and in the media.
Yeah, well, I guess going forward, we'll see how the CCP evolves. It seems like we're at a turning point, especially, I think we're, a year and a half into Xi Jinping's presidency now, and it's clear that he has some big plans for the party and for China. Well, thanks a lot for joining us, Shannon. Really appreciate your insight on China, and readers should definitely keep an eye on China Power blog, where Shannon writes daily.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Thank you, Shannon. Good to join you guys.
Yep. Thanks, and we'll be back next week with more.